The next September, I was invited to devastate the moors of a friend in the north, and on my journey to his abode, I unexpectedly came within 15 miles of Gimmerton. A sudden impulse seized me to visit Thrushcross Grange and my old companion there. I reached the Grange in the afternoon and knocked for admittance. "Is Mrs. Dean within?" I demanded of the dame who answered my knock.
"Mistress Dean? Nay, she don't abide here. She's up at Heights."
"All well at the Heights?" I inquired of the woman.
"Eh, for aught I know,"
she answered, scurrying away. I would have asked why Mrs. Dean had deserted the Grange, but I turned away and made my exit, rambling leisurely along, with the glow of the afternoon sun behind me as I quitted the park and climbed the stony by-road, branching off to Mr. Heathcliff's dwelling. There I found, to my surprise, that both doors and lattices were wide open, and I could hear voices issuing from within. I approached to where I could see the speakers without myself being observed.
"Contrary," said one voice, as sweet as a silver bell. "That for the third time, you dunce! I'm not going to tell you again. Recollect, or I pull your hair."
"Contrary, then," answered another, in deep but softened tones. "And now kiss me, for minding so well."
"No.
Read it over first correctly, without a single mistake." The male speaker began to read. He was a young man, respectably dressed, and seated at a table, having a book before him. His handsome features glowed with pleasure, and his eyes kept impatiently wandering from the page to a small white hand over his shoulder, which recalled him by a smart slap on the cheek whenever its owner detected such signs of inattention. Its owner stood behind, her light, shining ringlets blending at intervals with his own brown locks, as she bent to superintend his studies. I was astounded further to see that these two were Hareton Earnshaw and the young Mrs. Heathcliff. Not wishing to disturb them, I skulked round to seek refuge in the kitchen. At the door sat my old friend, Nellie Dean, sewing and singing to herself. I advanced, and recognizing me directly, she jumped to her feet, crying,
"Why, bless you, Mr. Lockwood! I didn't expect to see you here."
"Nor I you, Mrs. Dean," I replied. "However are you transplanted here? Tell me that."
"Zillah left, and Mr. Heathcliff wished me to come soon after you went to London." "Oh, but step in, pray."
"Is Mr. Heathcliff within?" I asked. She looked surprised.
"Oh, you have not heard, I see. Heathcliff is dead."
"Heathcliff dead?" I exclaimed, astonished. "How long ago?"
3 months since. But sit down and let me take your hat and I'll tell you all about it."
"Well, you sit down too, Mrs. Dean. I never dreamt of his dying. Let me hear how it came to pass." And so she furnished me with the sequel of Heathcliff's history.
"I was summoned to Wuthering Heights within a fortnight of your leaving us, Mr. Lockwood. And, I obeyed joyfully for Catherine's sake. My first interview with her grieved and shocked me. She'd altered so much since our separation. Mr. Heathcliff did not explain his reasons for taking a new mind about my coming here. He only told me he wanted me, and he was tired of seeing Catherine. I must make the little parlour my sitting-room and keep her with me. Catherine, contented at first, in a brief space grew irritable and restless. For one thing, she was forbidden to move out of the garden, and it fretted her sadly to be confined to its narrow bounds as spring drew on. For another, she complained of loneliness. She preferred quarrelling with Joseph in the kitchen to sitting at peace in her solitude. I did not mind their skirmishes, but Hareton was often obliged to seek the kitchen also when the master wanted to have the house to himself, and though in the beginning she either left it at his approach or quietly joined in my occupations and shunned remarking or addressing him, and though Hareton was always as sullen, as silent as possible, after a while she changed her behaviour and became incapable of letting him alone, talking at him, commenting on his stupidity and idleness, expressing her wonder how he could endure the life he lived, how he could sit a whole evening staring into the fire and dozing.
"He's just like a dog, is he not, Ellen?" she once observed, "or a cart horse. He does his work, eats his food, and sleeps eternally. What a blank, dreary mind he must have! Do you ever dream, Hareton? And if you do, what is it about?"
Then she looked at him, but he would neither open his mouth nor look again at her. Because he wouldn't rise to her bait, she was piqued, and decided he must learn to read. Well, the lad was none too pleased with this arrangement at first, but submitted to her strictures. The intimacy thus commenced grew rapidly, though it encountered temporary interruptions. Earnshaw was not to be civilised with a wish, and my young lady was no philosopher and no paragon of patience. But both their minds tending to the same point, one loving and desiring to esteem, and the other loving and desiring to be esteemed, they contrived in the end to reach it. "You see, Mr. Lockwood, the crown of all my wishes will be the union of these two. I shall envy no one on their wedding day. There won't be a happier woman than myself in England." Mr. Heathcliff had grown more pensive and given to moods. One day he said to me, "Nelly, there is a strange change approaching. I am in its shadow at present. I take so little interest in my daily life that I hardly remember to eat and drink." "What do you mean by change, Mr. Heathcliff?" I said, alarmed at his manner, though according to my judgment he was quite strong and healthy, and from childhood he'd had a delight in dwelling on dark things and entertaining odd fancies. He might have had a monomania on the subject of his departed idol, but on every other point his wits were as sound as mine. "I shall not know that till it comes," he said. "I'm only half conscious of it now." "You've no feeling of illness, have you?" I asked. "No, Nelly, I have not," he answered. "Then you're not afraid of death?" I pursued. "Afraid? No. Why should I? In this condition I have to remind myself to breathe, almost to remind my heart to beat. And it is like bending back a stiff spring. It is by compulsion that I do the slightest act, not prompted by one thought, and by compulsion that I notice anything alive or dead which is not associated with one universal idea. I have a single wish, and my whole being and faculties are yearning to attain it. They have yearned towards it so long and so unwaveringly that I'm convinced it will be reached, and soon, because it has devoured my existence. I am swallowed in the anticipation of its fulfillment.